Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome, come on in.
Welcome to the inaugural episode of The Third Date, the podcast dedicated to exploring our shared relationship to the movies. I'm your host, Marshall Walker Lee, and this week we're going to be discussing one of the most beloved films from the golden age of international cinema, Federico Fellini's Eight and a Half. In April 1963, Eight and a Half was screened out of competition at the Cannes Film Festival, where it was greeted with rapturous, almost comical acclaim. Critics André Bouzy and Raymond Bourdais wrote that it had the importance, magnitude, and technical mastery of Citizen Kane. In the United States, however, the film, which stars Marcello Mastroianni as Guido, a womanizing filmmaker suffering from creative block, received more measured praise. Though the film eventually went on to win the 1963 Best Foreign Language Academy Award, Pauline Kael called the movie a structural disaster, and Bosley Crowther of the New York Times wrote that the film has no more plot than a racehorse, and no more order than a pinball machine. Today, more than 50 years after its debut, Eight and a Half is justly celebrated as a masterpiece, and dozens of filmmakers, from Woody Allen to Charlie Kaufman, have paid tribute to Fellini's film in their own work. Academy Award-winning director Rob Marshall even remade the movie, sort of, as a musical, starring none other than Daniel Day-Lewis. But at its core, Eight and a Half remains what it always was, a funny, sad, sexy, and seriously weird exploration of one man's deeply flawed desires. That one man, Guido Anselmi, is, as novelist and critic Alberto Moravia wrote, obsessed by eroticism, a sadist, a masochist, a self-mythologizer, an adulterer, a clown, a liar, and a cheat. He's afraid of life, and he wants to return to his mother's womb. In one of the movie's better-known sequences, Guido does return to his childhood home, where he's pampered not only by his mother, but also by his wife, his mistress, and a dozen other women, including a prostitute, a circus performer, and a flight attendant. The women feed and bathe the great director, treating him, quite literally, like a big baby. The scene, which culminates with Guido using a whip to tame the women, is either a silly, self-indulgent display of male privilege, or a bracingly raw critique of the wounded narcissism that fuels the male ego. Fellini refuses to tell us which, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. Guido's frequent escapes into fantasy might be harmless flights of artistic fancy, or signs of an impending psychotic break. The films for which Guido is celebrated are either works of genius or, as one French intellectual in the film suggests, a squalid catalog of mistakes. The answers, dear listener, are for you and I to discover. Eight and a Half was selected for the podcast by today's guest, Joseph Maines, a poet and editor based in Portland, Oregon. Our conversation has been lightly edited for clarity and length. And now, without further delay, it's time for The Third Date. So what is Catholicism doing in this movie? There's a bunch of religious symbolism. There's the Seregina, who we have to talk about more, this symbol of like pure erotic energy, who the priests from his childhood tell him is the devil. I mean, is this just about, is it a criticism of Catholicism? Is it about what Catholicism says about how women are supposed to play a role in lives that are dominated by men? Or what is it?
I mean, in some ways, it's this Guy Guido, who is, you know, trying to play along with, and I hope I'm not stretching too much, but trying to play along with these structural norms, right, of, like, religion, of, you know, some sort of, like, nuclear family sort of deal, while being an artist. And in some ways, it feels like he is scared to let go of some of those things, or like he's in the film, maybe he's asking permission from some of these institutions in a way, if I could like project largely, he's asking permission from them to let go of them, I think, maybe. So, and I think that, yeah, maybe marriage and religion are like the two primary examples. Maybe there's others.
Yeah, that you're getting at something really interesting. For me, one of the things that's the most compelling about the movie is the way Guido reacts to anything. I mean, he seems to be asking for something from his wife, from the cardinal, but Mastroianni's performance, which is just this like hypnotic tour de force of kind of bemused, flat, almost absent joy in being in the moment. I mean, it's like he's somehow present and absent at the same time. He just sort of smiles beatifically. His performance is really the thing that anchors this movie, because the characters are all fairly thin. But you can never really tell how he feels about anything.
Yeah.
Or that's how it reads to me. I watch him listening to someone else, and the moment they're done talking, it's almost like the conversation never happened for him. Is that how do you read his performance?
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I find him to be incredibly like present all of the time, and we don't really get any sort of perspective in terms of, except through maybe like flashbacks and dreams, but we never really get anything like on his interior, right? Like there's no real, like the characters don't really like develop each other through any sort of like story building or like dialogue exactly, you know, like they talk about philosophy, they talk about, you know, preferences maybe a bit, but like there's no, like we don't know if these guys have, if Guido and his wife have kids, we don't know really all that much about their relationship except that he's clearly a philanderer. And she's clearly fed up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think that they're the main, you know, he's the main character. From there, it just becomes even more thin. So in some ways, like the whole film, I think, is about kind of being present in this strange way. And,
yeah, there's something really interesting, in what you just said about what he does, sort of like if he has an interior life, and if he does, do we see it? He's this character in the movie who's just beset on all sides by people demanding things of him. So there's these incredible scenes where essentially the camera spins around him in a big 360, and every time he turns, there's a new person who's trying to ask him a question or bother him. And so you feel like, and he's obviously a smart guy, he's an artist, filmmaker, you feel like when he's alone, he would just be brooding or gasping for breath. And we get these few precious scenes of him alone, and he's like dancing or humming a tune to himself. There's that wonderful scene where he's alone in the hallway for a moment.
Yeah,
and he just starts
clicking
dancing.
His feet. Yep. Absolutely, right? You see him in the bathroom, and he's just kind of like fucking with his face, you know, in the mirror. Like, you know, and it's like totally non-judgmental. It's Yeah, he's like,
and he sings that march, that he just, once he gets that in his head, that becomes like the soundtrack to his interior life for half the movie.
Totally. Yeah.
So let's jump back to the beginning of the movie and walk through it a little more step by step. So, you know, this movie has one of the most famous opening scenes and closing scenes, first and last scenes of all time. The movie fades up on a car in a traffic jam, and you don't see who's driving, but something bad starts happening, and the driver starts freaking out, trying to get out of the car, and he can't. He's locked in, and it seems like the car is maybe filling with smoke. Does that seem right, or
right.
something?
Mm-hmm.
And he's flailing around in the car, kicking at the glass, can't get out, and It hadn't occurred to me before the few other times I've watched this movie, but that opening scene really reads like a horror movie.
Oh, yeah.
There's just a montage of these faces all staring at him, and the angles are impossible. There's no way he's seeing what we're seeing as the camera.
Right.
But it's just like every other person is watching him suffocate to death. And thinking about the fact that when we spend time alone with Guido later in the movie, he's so laid back and just whistling and dancing. I don't know quite what to make of those scenes. The few scenes that feel like horror movies to me, I mean, is that what it's like in his head? Is he actually terrified and losing his mind? What is the context for that first scene?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, right? Because in some ways, it's tempting for me to view that as this kind of like opening poem or opening metaphor that kind of like lays out, in some ways, the idea of like fame in the creative process, right? Like he's not in a fishbowl, he's in a car, mm-hmm. but kind of similar sort of thing.
Yeah, everyone's watching him.
Yeah, everybody's watching him. He's like packed in this world of gridlock, and yeah, he's the spectacle. He's trying to escape. Everybody else is in their own little car too, right? Or big car, or whatever, and he's the one that's trying to kind of like break free out of this thing. They're content sitting in their cars, kind of staring at him. And in some ways, I'm tempted to like push it into the metaphorical realm and think of it as a meditation on the creative problems that he is facing, right? And that, in some ways, maybe that's the one interior like moment of the character Guido in the film, is that opening sequence when we don't even know the character at all.
So let's, thinking about scenes, let's jump into what is, I think, the most famous, infamous scene in the movie, Guido in his harem. he goes into a fantasy sequence, Guido does. He's in a giant white, I don't know, like manor, castle, house, spa, something. And he's surrounded by, it seems like, every woman he's ever known. Mm-hmm. His mom's there, his mistress, Seragina, the woman who, you know, enchanted him and his adolescent friends. And they're all, what's a polite way to say it? Servicing him?
Uh-huh.
And, I think the iconic image from the movie is Guido with his whip, right?
Right.
Taming all these women as they rush at him. But the thing that, even if you watch the movie a couple of times, that you can forget about in that scene is the woman who's being cut loose and sent upstairs. Yeah, mm-hmm. So run that down for me. What exactly is happening with that woman?
Let's see. What is happening with that woman?
She's like a can-can dancer, yeah?
She's a can-can dancer. Right? They say she's 26, and clearly,
she looks like she's 50.
Yeah, the actress is in her like 40s or 50s, right? And this woman is just, she's busted and she is...
Wait. Let's break down what sort of busted she is. So she's, first of all, we should extend her a little sympathy because she's not in her own fantasy sequence.
She's in
someone else's fantasy, but she's wearing her can-can outfit.
Right.
She's had better days.
Right. They call her... it's very much like from the perspective of this male gaze where, you know, like they call her out as being 26 over and over again, right? So the implication is on your 26th birthday, you go upstairs. They say, you know, you're treated as well, just as well up there, but you just, you know,
you don't get Guido's attention anymore.
Yeah, uh-huh, right.
Even though several of the women downstairs are obviously over 26.
Absolutely.
If not all of them.
Absolutely, right? If not all of them. So this woman is so obsessed and so in love with, like attending to and pleasuring Guido that she cannot stand the idea of her not getting that attention.
She begs as she's going up the stairs. She begs, I'm only 26.
Give me one more year. Give me any extension, Guido. Like, please, you know?
So,
and he's, yeah.
So this scene, it's all through Guido's point of view. This woman lives to serve him, and there's an arbitrary date where she's no longer going to be useful. I mean, presumably because she's no longer sexually desirable. And he sends her away, and she seems to have no interior life. Like, it's not like she's like, great, I'm getting sent upstairs. I'm just going to paint my watercolors and read Proust. This is amazing. Right. She is devastated because she'll no longer get his attention. What are we supposed to take away? And this isn't a character from the movie. This is a woman we've never seen before.
Right. Totally. This is, yeah, like, this is pulled out. Like, she's this example that we have no other connection with. And, you know, yeah. And this scene is saying, well, you know what? Essentially, like, hey, them's the rules. Like, what, you know, we all know that this is the law.
Okay, I don't even know what else to say about this. I also think at this point in the podcast, we've officially lost 51% of our listeners. So
right. Fair enough.
let's pivot away. We all agree forward that the women are the stars of the film. These incredibly enchanting Italian women. His wife, his mistress, the Seraghina, who is... What is the Seraghina? Just a beast of pure sensual energy.
Yeah.
You know, Claudia Cardinale is some sort of spiritual water nymph.
Yeah. She's the platonic woman.
Yeah. These women own the movie and they own Guido's life. And this is obviously, on some level, a movie just about how all men want nothing but to understand women and yet fail miserably.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's why we make art. It's why we watch movies.
Yep. It's why we make podcasts about watching art. Yeah.
Right.
This is I had forgotten temporarily. This conversation just reminded me of the single moment in 8 and a half that struck me the hardest watching the movie again this time. There's a moment in the in about 3/4 of the way through the movie where Guido is talking to someone, I can't even remember who now, and he articulates what he wants out of life. And I thought, oh, this is the movie's piece of profound wisdom. This is the thing that is actually the most like life about this movie. Guido says to somebody, all I want is to tell the truth without having to make anyone else suffer.
Oh, right.
And it's so obviously impossible for him. All he does is lie. I mean, in a way, filmmakers, artists are professional liars, but he's also, in his personal life, a pathological liar. But you get the feeling that all the lies he tells are because he thinks he's going to cause less suffering. But that's the disconnect, right? Is he's unhappy in his life. Insofar as he is unhappy at all, he's unhappy because he's trying to make people suffer less, but in order to do so, he's not telling the truth. And what he wants is both of those things at once.
Right. In some ways, that's kind of the... In some ways, that feels like the Catholic part of the movie. You know, that desire.
Yeah, I want to be bad and I want to be forgiven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Like, I want to do whatever I want and I want it to be okay. And I want everybody to, yeah, I want everybody to say it's okay.
Is that possible, though? I mean, this is like years of our friendship and conversations rolled into a single question, but is it that... I think one of the reasons that moment in the movie struck me so much was I was thinking about you watching the movie and about our lives. And when he said that, I realized in a lot of ways that's what you and I have been talking about for years when we talk about art or when we talk about friendships or relationships that we've had and talk about our friendship. We're both, I think, people who want to be honest all the time. Because maybe in a selfish way, because we want to be honest with ourselves, and it's just not economical to lie to other people because it involves wasting your own energy. But we want to be honest all the time, but we want everyone to love us for it. We don't want to hurt anybody.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, I want to be honest all the time, and I want everybody to see that honesty and accept it in this radical way that's incredibly loving and generous. And if they don't, I kind of naively feel...
shocked?
Yes! I feel scandalized.
How can you not recognize the gift of being honest that I have given you?
Absolutely.
But I think in a real way, in a like utopian in both senses, in the sense of being like the perfect place and no place, an impossible place, it's a utopian ideal. We want to be able to say what's true and not have to deal with the impossibly complex, convoluted web of other people's emotional states through their reaction to what is true and what we say. We want the fact that the thing we say is true to be like a kind of axe that cuts through feelings and gives us all a ground to stand on, where we're like, well, there's no reason for us to overreact or be upset about anything because we're just telling the truth. It's that moment of when you end a relationship or when you end a friendship or when you say something that you've been keeping inside to a boss or a coworker or a friend, and you're measured in the way you express it. And what you're hoping in some naive way is that they're going to be like, well, my God, that's very hurtful on some level, what you said, because you pinpointed something in me that is deficient. But I have to admire your honesty. And because you were honest, I don't see any reason to get emotional about it. I mean, is it like, are we on the autism spectrum for that?
Yeah.
I mean, I love emotion. I want to be emotional. I want people to be emotional. But there is that thing where you want to be able to tell the truth and not have to deal with the other person's emotions, because they're like, well, I'm not going to suffer just because you told me the truth. That's just the way it is.
Right. Totally. But I every now and then I have a feeling or a reality check by the people that I do that to.
Yeah, that reality check is called all of life.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that is not how it works. And, right, I kind of, to me, it's this complex thing because on one hand, I'm trying to do this thing because, like you say, I want to be honest. I want to be honest with myself, and that extends to other people. And also, like you say, it's actually a lot more economical to be honest than to create all of these lies. And it's easier for me to accept myself, like, you know, all sorts of shit. But when other people turn that sort of radical honesty onto me, I do tend to poke a lot of logical holes in the...
It's tough taking the honesty.
Uh-huh. It kind of is. I mean...
That's getting at a real deep thing, which is that honesty that Guido talks about and that you and I are talking about. We all want to think that honesty is objective because we want to be understood, but you say something that feels completely honest to you, and... you know, every once in a while you're with someone you love and respect, and just like Guido and his wife, you know, he's just trying to be honest with her, but she doesn't understand it. And it's because her objective reality is different than his, you know, with big scare quotes around it, objective. It's like when someone says something to you and you know they're being honest, but it just feels wrong to you. Yeah, that's a painful place to live in.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think... especially maybe at least when I was a little bit younger, not that I'm immune to it now, but when I was a little bit younger, I think I was a lot more ready to kind of dole out that sort of objective truth, you know?
Yeah. When you're young, you want to be like some avenging angel with the blazing sword of truth.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, you get a little bit older and you're like, oh, shit, you know.
You realize that everybody else is just trying to live. Like, just trying to make it home at night and be able to make dinner and sleep and not be miserable.
Right, totally. And you've just got this whole special other agenda that they may or not be signed up for. Right. So.
And the flip side of that, or the outcome that is both what you secretly want and what you know is not going to make you happy, is every once in a while you say something truthful to someone, and for you it's just this objective truth you're expressing, and the moment you say it, you just read in their face that it was the most inappropriate and terribly wrong thing you could have said. That regardless of whether or not it's truthful, there was no reason for it to be said, and you're a monster for having said.
Oh yeah, totally, totally. Well, you know, and you can, it's, and when you do that, it's really easy to trace back like the kind of logical steps that got you there, and like it's a lot of times, at least for me, easy to say like, oh well, you know, I mean, if I'm looking at it this way, none of that was technically wrong, but you know, in like the larger picture of the thing.
That's part of Guido's power in this movie, right, is that he doesn't say much to anyone.
Right.
He gets cross-examined by all sorts of people, but he normally just sort of ducks and dodges. People ask him questions and he just turns away. He never has to say the uncomfortable thing. He's mastered the art of pure evasion.
Yeah, everybody around him always has to do the sort of like intellectual work or emotional work to kind of get through a thing, and he, yeah, is constantly just like evading that and, you know, like deflecting it back to them.
And even when they say the hurtful truth, the writer, the critic, when the writer tells him like, your movie's empty, your movie is just disconnected episodes and it doesn't mean anything, Guido doesn't get mad at him. He doesn't even seem to be affected by it. He just says, oh good, I'm glad you told me that, and then walks off like he never heard it.
Yeah. Amazing.
And in a way, that's what we're all aspiring to, right? We want to take in other people's truth and not be affected by it.
Absolutely.
So let's wrap things up, let's dive into what is, you know, superficially but importantly, the central mystery of this movie. And it's the it's sort of the meme that the movie has wrought on the world. And I'm talking about Asa Nisimasa.
Fuck yeah.
So Asa Nisimasa, let's set it up. In the movie, Guido's at the spa. There's a kind of psychic who has a stage assistant who's a woman who supposedly read minds, and this psychic goes around and kind of puts his hand over people's heads, and supposedly his assistant can read their thoughts. Guido doesn't seem to want to be a part of it. He walks away. But as he's walking away, the magician runs up to him, the psychic runs up to him, and they seem to know each other, which is bizarre. There's no explanation for that. And Guido says to the psychic something to the effect of, oh, she can read any thought? And the psychic says, yeah, I don't know how it works, but she can. So Guido says, okay, and he thinks for a moment, and the assistant on stage is baffled. She doesn't know what to say, but she's obviously reading something, so she writes on a blackboard these three words, Asa Nisimasa. And Guido says, yep, that's what I thought. And the psychic says, what does it mean? And Guido doesn't answer. And then we immediately go back into this flashback. And so, do you remember the flashback? Can you describe that?
Yeah, and so the flashback actually has like certain visual cues that are similar to the kind of like harem scene, right? Where like they're in this, you know, boys' school or whatever it is.
Or is it his childhood home?
Maybe. There are many kids there, and the kids, you know, are all in this bit large bedroom, and they close the doors, and, you know, they say, okay, like, if you have to say Asa Nisimasa, and, like...
There's a big painting on the wall.
To the painting, right, exactly, and, like...
She says if you say certain words, the painting's eyes will move, right?
The painting's eyes will move, and you'll, like, you'll get rich or something like that. And so that's where Asa Nisimasa comes from.
Okay, so, yes, that's where Asa Nisimasa comes from. Basically, that's the only place we see it in the movie. It's a kind of rosebud, right?
Yes, absolutely.
He's an adult. He's in this period of high stress and difficulty in his professional and creative and personal lives. he has this one moment, seems to be kind of snatched out of time, where this psychic asks him to think of something, and that's what he thinks of. And when we see the explanation, it's this moment of both pure childlike engagement in the present moment, just like what childhood feels like in every artistic representation of it. Like, you're surrounded by other kids, it's beautiful and fun, and the world is all centering on you. But there's also a terror in it, right? He seems, in the flashback, he seems afraid of the painting. He doesn't want the painting to look at him.
Yeah, the painting's kind of creepy. It's like, I mean, it feels kind of like doing the, like, Bloody Mary or some of those weird, like, games that you would play when you're a little kid having a sleepover, you know?
Yeah, you're daring the world to show you how scary it is.
Mm-hmm, totally.
So why has Asa Nisimasa lived on in popular culture as this thing? I googled it the other day. There's like film companies named after it, all these groups, all these people who use that. Why?
It's fascinating, right? I mean, in some ways it's kind of like it feels a little bit to me, I mean, this is really personal, but it feels a little bit to me like this kind of yeah, maybe I was touching on it earlier with, like, the sleepover thing and the Bloody Mary. It feels like this kind of sort of, like, this otherworldly incantation that kind of, or, like, a conjuring, you know, into a realm of, like, spirituality or darkness or scariness or, you know, whatever.
Maybe this is how Catholicism comes back in. As a kid, when you're a young child, everything seems to you like black magic.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Driving, right? Jobs, everything. And so everything. Religion is the high watermark of that. I mean, it's especially Catholicism. It's all, I mean, think of he grew up going to Latin Mass. It's nonsense words and magic.
Yeah, right. And really crazy costumes. And it's like, yeah, I mean, so in some ways, this is, you know, you have these, like, moments with other kids who also are kind of have that same level of experience, and you're experimenting with that black magic for kind of the first time, you know, like, that's in some ways that's the first time that you're, like, transgressing in a way that is deeper than your parents getting mad at you, you know, like you're really getting into shit that, like, as far as your mind is able to, like, conceptualized, way outside of your, like,
league. Yeah, so you grew up with some Catholicism in your head.
Yeah.
Like, as a Catholic kid, did you grow up thinking that the world was charged with these kind of spirits that had to do with the religious stuff?
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, my parents would go around, like, you know, anointing, like, the tops of our doorways and all throughout our house with, like, oil and, like, saying all of these prayers and, like, doing all this thing, and they're like, we're doing this to keep evil spirits out. This is the only thing that's keeping evil spirits out. Oh, yeah. And you're just like, oh, shit, okay. I mean, you're 7, you know? What do you know? Like, you barely, like, an evil spirit is, like, just the scariest guy that you've seen in the grocery store.
The tissue-thin boundary between you and the spirit world is a bit of oil on your door.
It's just like, you know, it's insane. And so then, you know, and you tell each other these, so when you tell each other these scary stories, there's, like, zero reason why it would possibly be false, because you know that, like, there's, you know that there's all these crazy ass fucking ghosts or whatever, like, you know, powers and principalities and things unknown around you that like, that could come inside you and, like, take you over and live inside of you and fuck you up and send you to hell, you know? Yeah. And so you're like...
So, to wrap up this, the talk about the movie itself, is this a movie that makes you feel good?
Marshall, it kind of is. It kind of is. I didn't used to at all. Now...
What about it? Enlighten me.
To me, I like to. I'm interested in thinking about it as, like, an artist and somebody who makes stuff and somebody who thinks a lot about, you know, what it is that I'm making. And Guido's ability to kind of like let everything roll off of him, be totally present, and you know, allow life to kind of like, he does what he wants, but he does not try really hard to like grip life and like control it. And I think that that sort of effortlessness is in some ways kind of a joy to watch. Maybe it's because it's so privileged, it's kind of fanciful, but there's something about it that you know, there's something about it that allows me to kind of like enter into that space for a short time and do it in a way that's intellectually kind of like stimulating. And
it's a pretty movie.
I think that's
I mean, you can enter into like the best version of that, the version where things turn out happy and everyone is holding hands and dancing.
Right. I mean, you get like, if by getting to the end of the movie, you've like, the movie has become a success, you know? And so in some ways there's this takeaway of like, you know, by doing, you're succeeding at your art, you know? And, well, John Cage says this thing, right? Like, out of the work comes the work. And in some ways, 8.5, I think, does...
What does that mean?
Out of the work comes the work.
Yeah.
In Narrow Road to the Interior, right, there's this idea that that a poet is always making poems, and, you know, it just so happens that some of them are written down, but, like, it's really about a state of being or a perspective, mm-hmm. you know, or like you say, a practice or a process. And I like that sort of thing, because then, like, if one's going to call themselves an artist or, you know, whatever, what you're really making at the end of the day is you're making your life. And, you know, that kind of manifests itself in these different ways. But really, it's, you know, the largest project you're doing is your life.
I never liked the idea that, like, your whole life is a work of art. Because it felt to me like it was kind of materialist and like, well, the things I buy and wear and the way my house looks and the movies I watch are all my work of art that I'm making. But the older I get, the more I think like, well, there's no guarantee that anything you make is going to survive for a long time. I mean, anything could happen. You know, society could crumble. There could be an apocalypse. God knows what you make that will survive. So as long as you are alive, your life, which is the just, I guess, just the totality of all the things you do, like the way you treat people, the things you buy and own, the things you make, everything. In some ways, I can't argue against that being the only piece of art that you make.
And, right. Yeah. In some ways, I just kind of feel like, well, if in some ways, this idea of out of the work comes the work, you know, it's like, well, that's just another way of saying that what you do is the life that you have.
Well, and that's the essence of 8.5, right? He's not suffering from writer's block or director's block. He's life blocked. I mean,
yeah.
There's no separation between his life and his art. He can't figure out how to live, so he can't figure out what to make.
Totally.
Well,
right.
Yeah.
And then in some ways, 8.5 is a perfect example, actually, of out of the work comes the work. Right. So he just starts making a movie about making the movie. And then all of a sudden it becomes, you know, this thing that we're talking about, you know, in 2015.
Yeah. Well, shit. That's the great irony of the movie. Right. Is it's a movie about a director who can't make a movie.
Uh-huh.
But Fellini made his movie. I mean, I think it's tempting to think of 8.5 as the movie that Fellini made when he didn't know what to make. But there's no reason to think that's true unless Fellini somehow said so in his diaries. This is a movie about a guy who doesn't know what to make. But Fellini knew exactly what to make. He made the movie about the guy who doesn't know what to make.
Right. I guess it's easy in that context to read it as this really triumphant film, right? You're like, well, so the actual hero of the film is Fellini himself outside of the film, you know?
Yeah, well, kind of... hard to make the triumphant film about the guy who climbs under the table and shoots himself in the head in the penultimate scene.
Right. Right.
So, okay, I have one last question for you.
Okay.
I called this podcast The Third Date in part because I love the Carol Reed movie The Third Man.
Right.
But also because for a long time I had a kind of running joke with a friend of mine how if we liked somebody who we were dating, we'd go on a couple dates, and then on the third date we would always take them to go see a movie or watch a movie. And both of us were kind of obnoxious film nuts, and so on the third date inevitably you'd make them watch something difficult. You'd make them watch Holy Mountain or Stalker.
Exactly what I was thinking of.
something that's going to separate the wheat from the chaff. And and if they couldn't, I mean, who cares if they like it or they don't or whatever. It's just, if somebody can't watch, you know, F is for Fake or The Conversation and talk about it for 15 minutes afterwards, we're probably not going to date them for a long time. So one of the things that intrigued me about doing a podcast about movies was thinking about the way that like movies have intersected in my life and in relationships. So I would be remiss if I didn't take an opportunity to ask you, have movies played like a big role for you in love life and relationships and in sort of like whether it's personal or interpersonal dealing with romance stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think they really have. It's, you know, the last time actually I watched 8 and a Half was like right before I think my last child was conceived. I think that most of...
Well, like, shit, Joseph, I'm going to go ahead and say that this is only the first episode of The Third Date, but I think we can claim at least one child already.
One child? You can. All right. Yeah.
Great.
That's verified. I think that I've tended to date folks who, for you know, in different ways have cared about films, but probably one of the great loves of my life we met watching our neighbors. We were neighbors. We all got together one summer and spent every night of the summer watching the 100 AFI 100 best films of all time or whatever. Okay. And so we kind of built this courtship slowly every night over, like, you know, watching these films together and you know, you can really kind of mark the like developments of, you know, of what turned into this relationship. Yeah.
I held your hand for the first time at some like a hot, and we kissed at The Godfather 2.
Totally. I think that film specifically, more than probably almost any other media, has played like a pretty defining role in just about all of my relationships. Funny enough, I'd never really thought about that. I love that.
Thanks for listening to the Third Date podcast. Today's episode was written, recorded, and edited by me, Marshall Walker Lee. Thanks again to today's special guest, Joseph Maines. If you like the show, you can follow us on Twitter at Third Date Podcast, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. We'll be back next month with a new guest and a new film to discuss. Until then, so long, farewell, auf Wiedersehen, and good night.